Ladies and gentlemen, the sound you hear is a buzzsaw ripping through a painting of George Washington chopping down cherry trees. It's time for Professor Buzzkill, busting myths and taking names.
Hello, Buzzkillers. It's your favorite professor here, and I've got one of my favorite professors here with me in the Buzzkill Bunker, Dr. William Campbell, who teaches history and religious studies at the University of Pittsburgh at Greensburg. Thank you for joining us, Professor. How are you?
Doing very well, thanks. Yourself?
Great. We're going to talk today about St. Francis of Assisi, one of the most famous, most popular, most well-known saints in the Christian church. He was born in 1181. He died in 1226, a long time ago. But he's always in books. He's in art. He's in movies. We have even now the Pope is named Francis. Why do you think Francis is so popular?
I think the reason Francis is so popular is that we're kind of looking, I think, for somebody who's the real thing, for somebody who's not corrupted. Uh-huh. And if you look at Francis, you see somebody who has outright rejected the things that normally corrupt people, money, sex, and power.
Saint Francis, not necessarily the Pope. Yeah, the final word isn't in on him yet.
Although they're both enigmatic figures, people disagree about. So they've got that in common too. But yeah, Francis of Assisi came from a wealthy merchant background, and he rejected wealth so thoroughly that he didn't even allow his friars to touch money with their hands.
Wow. He
and his followers, of course, were celibates. And the correct name of the Franciscan order, which was never called that during his lifetime, is the Order of Friars Minor, meaning the Order of Lesser Brethren. So this emphasis on humility. So when somebody has comprehensively rejected those things that normally corrupt people, you get a sense that you're not dealing with somebody who's trying to work an angle.
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons we see so many quotes from him,
sure.
So many people trying to emulate him. There's a very famous prayer we'll talk about in a minute to him. But in the course, really, of retelling his life, he's had many biographies written about him, of course, very close to the time he died. But over and over and over again, he's constantly talked about. There must have been tons of opportunities for misunderstandings to creep in. What are some of those?
I think of there being three orders of myths. The first order is things that just aren't true, things that Francis never did, things that he never actually said.
Okay, the basic, completely untrue.
Right, fabrications. But there are also ones that the second order of myths are things that he probably did say or do. But as modern people, we're perhaps misunderstanding what the story actually means.
And not surprising because it's a thousand years-ish since it happened. Yeah.
And then, of course, there's sort of a third order myth, which is the overall picture we have of Francis, not the particulars or the specifics, but the general personality image that we have of him.
Oh, that's interesting because that's one of the things that's so powerful, the gentleness, the care of animals and that sort of thing.
Sure.
Okay, but let's start with the first order myths, the stories that just aren't true. What are some of those?
Well, you mentioned a moment ago this prayer of St. Francis that begins, Lord, make me a channel of your peace or make me an instrument of your peace. That is only about 100 years old.
Oh, no kidding.
It seems that it probably dates from the First World War or maybe slightly before then.
Hmm.
And it may be a prayer inspired by the example of Francis, but it certainly was not written by Francis.
Okay, even though we call it that and people refer to that, I need to say the prayer of St. Francis.
Right. So
my mother used to say that
to
her. You know, I'm saying the prayer of St. Francis.
Yeah, it's okay if you, as a title, if you put it in quotes, I guess.
Okay.
And then there are other stories like the taming of the wolf of Gubbio. There are a lot of animal stories about Francis, and this is one where there's this wolf outside the town of Gubbio who is terrorizing the livestock. And Francis basically calls a conference between the townspeople and the wolf, and he has them come to an agreement whereby the wolf promises to stop eating their sheep and calves and things, and they promise to leave some food out for the wolf from time to time. And the wolf even like signifies its assent by raising its paw or something like that. I think we can conclude that outside of an outright miracle, this is not a true story.
Right.
But it probably the message, this is in a time when Italy was very politically fractured and very stratified as to what we would now call class boundaries. This is probably a story that is really about trying to bring peace between rich and poor, between powerful and weak.
Oh, okay.
And the wolf kind of standing in for the Italian nobility and kind of making a lesson that, look, even if the wolf can bend its nature to be gentle, then surely Italian noblemen ought to be able to do the same.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, that actually makes it more interesting in a way. If it was used in that way, it was actually a useful myth, or could have been a useful myth.
Yeah, the real story is often a lot more interesting than the myth when you get down to it.
Well, but that's an excellent myth to talk about, because as we said, and as you say, the Francis is usually thought as the patron saint of animals. He's very gentle. Birds are apparently landing on his fingers, and he's able to tame animals, tame the wolf, etc. There are famous paintings where these sorts of things are happening. Do you think there's any truth to this story about animals and him having an actual special relationship with them?
Well, some people are just really good with animals, and that's something that shows up in the earliest biographies of Francis. The first one's written only about 2 years after his death, and it stays as a theme throughout. So there's probably, at the very least, a kernel of truth to that.
Okay, so the people who are writing, who may have even known him, but certainly writing very close to the time he lived.
Yes.
Or saying that the animal thing is at least partly true.
Yeah. Okay. And the most famous story, of course, is his the story of him preaching a sermon to the birds.
Mm-hmm.
And you see that in paintings a lot. And this might be one of these second-order myths where something like this happened, but maybe we don't understand exactly what it meant.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So the story told by Thomas of Celano, the first biographer, is that he's walking along one day and he sees these birds on the path and he thinks, gosh, it's really kind of odd that I've never preached to birds before. And so he walks up to the birds and they don't fly away.
Right.
They sit there patiently and he preaches them a little sermon about how they should be grateful to God for taking care of them, which is actually a kind of a riff on something Jesus said, how God takes care of the birds. And they should be grateful for the ability to fly. And then Thomas actually said he walked over and patted each one of the birds on the head. and from that time onward, he made a habit of preaching to animals.
Oh, no kidding. And preaching to animals always have this sort of same calming effect on the animals, and he's able to approach them, and he's given the same message of you should be grateful that God is leaving out grain or whatever.
Yeah, definitely this having a way with animals and being able to approach them when other people couldn't. The question, though, is what does the story mean?
Mm-hmm.
Because just a few years later, there's an English monk named Roger of Wendover who is writing a chronicle, and he tells this story about Francis too, but he sets it in a different context. He said this is right after Francis had been in Rome, and Francis is trying to preach to the Romans, and they don't want to listen to him. So they kick him out on his ear.
Yeah.
And kind of shaking the dust off his sandals, he walks away from Rome and he finds these birds and he preaches to them and they listen, unlike the Romans. So there's a deliberate contrast set up between the Romans who are, you know, this is the home of the papacy, this is this ancient Christian city. These people ought to know to listen to his message, and they don't, and the brute beasts do. Now, it has to be said that English churchmen in general and the monks of St. Albans, including Roger of Wendover in particular, were really xenophobic about Italians.
Which is a problem because it's the home of the church.
Yeah, they had nothing good to say about Italians, or very rarely. They said nice things about Francis, but not about Italians in general.
Oh, okay.
So this is exactly the kind of xenophobic comment you might expect an English monk chronicler to make at this time. So we should take it even that with a grain of salt, but there may be a kernel of truth to it. You know, maybe it is true that Francis, it is true that some people didn't want to listen to his message. then there is this story that the birds did. And so Roger might be kind of setting those up as a deliberate contrast that to shame the people who weren't listening to his message right. when even the animals did.
Right. That's actually very fascinating. It's not surprising that a lot of those monks might have been xenophobic mm-hmm. because in theory they were afraid of Vikings and they were afraid of other raiders and other travelers.
Right.
What other sort of second-order myths, as you call them, are there?
Well, other than the prayer of St. Francis, the quote from Francis that is most often repeated by Catholics and Protestants alike is, preach the gospel at all times. If necessary, use words.
Oh, right. Saying you should preach the gospel by showing by example.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And this is a really thoroughly medieval thing to say. I've done a lot of research on medieval preaching. And everybody talks about preaching by word and example. That's just a standard thing. What makes this quote a little different is that it seems to suggest that that you should preach by example primarily and only use words when you need to.
Right, as a last resort.
As a last resort. But it's a misquote.
Oh, no kidding.
It's taken as kind of a general injunction to Christians to lead an exemplary life.
We love misquotes on this show. we made a fortune from Churchill quote or no quote.
But here's what he actually wrote, and this is in the rule, the earlier version of the rule for the Franciscan order. In the section on preachers, it begins, "Let no brother preach against the ritual and practice of the church or without the permission of his minister." Minister is their term for like an abbot, so mm-hmm. his superior in the order. "Let the minister be careful of granting it without discernment to anyone. Let all the brothers, however, preach by their deeds." So it's not a general injunction to Christians. It's a specific rule in the order that actually comes out of concerns about heresy.
Oh, no kidding. This is getting much, much more complex and interesting.
Yeah, the... So in the period before Francis, in the decades before he formed his order, there were other groups like his that were forming, the Waldensians and the Umiliati. And in both cases, some or all of their members wound up being officially branded heretics because they were lay people who— or many of them were lay people, and they believed that they had a divine call to preach the gospel.
Yeah.
Which sounds fine, except under church law, you have to be a clergyman to preach the gospel. And so there would have been this tension in those other orders where in which people said, well, look, God says we have to preach, and the Pope says no. God must be right, therefore the Pope must be wrong.
Right.
And
right.
So they actually rebelled against Catholic authority by insisting that they had this call to preach. And there were probably people in Francis's movement, which was also a mixture of lay people and clergy. There were probably people in his movement, lay people, who also thought that they ought to preach.
Right.
And what Francis is doing here is providing a way, on the one hand, to keep them quiet and within the bounds by saying, well, look, you are preaching. You're preaching by setting a good example. That's
right,
preaching.
Right, right. Oh, okay.
And at the same time, his order is very new. It's only recently been approved by the Pope. And he needs to be able to reassure the Pope that his order is not going to go the way of the Waldensians and wind up on the wrong side of the law.
Okay. Okay. So there's an internal church. There's a motive for fixing things within his own order in this saying,
right.
in this sort of admonition.
Yeah. So it's a matter of church politics and church law more than anything else.
Okay. Rather than talking to, you know, everyone out there in Christendom to preach the gospel
right.
using their works rather than words.
Right.
Are there other sayings and other things, quotes, if you will, by Francis that get misunderstood or misinterpreted?
Well, one that is certainly authentic—it's authentic as anything we know from him—is this poem called "The Canticle of the Creatures."
Ah, the animals again.
Yes. Well, it's not animals in this case. It's creatures in the sense of created things.
Oh no! Okay.
I don't think animals get mentioned this time. But this is where you get blessed be my Lord through brother sun and sister moon, and through earth and fire, and you know, the elements, the four elements are right. Mentioned there. So Francis dictated this on his deathbed, and it's as I said, as certain as anything else we have from him is that he did actually say this.
Okay,
and so this is part of the picture of Francis as this kind of eco saint, but he was actually doing something here that his earliest biographer realized what he was doing. But I think a lot of people take this out of context that they don't. This is actually biblical paraphrase.
Oh, okay.
There's a passage in Catholic Bibles, it's in the book of Daniel. In Protestant Bibles, it's in kind of taken out and put in the Apocrypha, called the Song of the Three Young Men, which is much longer than this. And it's a long litany asking all of these different elements of creation, you know, the sun and the moon and the stars and cold and frost and rain and snow and all sorts of things, to praise God, their maker. So this is actually just a boiled down version of that.
Oh, okay.
So Francis was reflecting this, what we now call an ecological theme, but he wasn't inventing it. This is just a boiled down version of something that was in the Bible itself, and was repeated in the Catholic liturgy as well.
Oh, okay. So it's not uncommon. It's not necessarily from his genius, if you will.
Exactly.
So when we see it on posters in yoga studios and things like that, and it says Saint Francis on it, then we don't have to have a sort of buzzkill outrage about it being a misquote. One of the things that interests me so much about Saint Francis is because he's depicted as such a pacifist on the one hand, yet he's living in this crusading era, you know, which seems to be an almost, you know, mini world war, if you will, or certainly many world, you know, battles across in the Middle East. Do we know anything about his attitudes towards the Crusades?
Sort of. It's controversial.
Good. That's good. That drives ratings.
Yes. And there's a story that, again, this is there's no reason to doubt this story, that in 1219, he went to Egypt, where the Fifth Crusade was then going on.
Right.
And he secured safe passage across the lines. There was a temporary truce while negotiations were going on with the Sultan. And he secured safe passage across the lines to visit the Sultan, who allowed him to come in. He stayed in the Sultan's court for a few days. He had an audience with the Sultan. Almost certainly tried to convince the Sultan to convert. The Sultan clearly didn't.
Yep.
And then the Sultan gave him safe passage back to his own people. And we have observers who were there or nearby who know this story. The question is, what did Francis say when he was with the Sultan, and what did he say after? That's what we don't know. Again, almost certainly he would have been trying to persuade the Sultan to convert.
Right.
But the question is, when he got back to the Catholic lines afterwards, was he against the Crusades or wasn't he? There are, as I said, there are people arguing about this to this day. There's a book by Christoph Meyer called Preaching the Crusades, and a book by John Toland called St. Francis and the Sultan. Both of them look at this. And both of them come to the conclusion, based on these sources, that Francis was entirely conventional in his view of the Crusades, that he was not at all, there's no reason to think from that he was opposed to them.
Right.
On the other hand, I was at a conference just last week, and I heard a Franciscan who is an academic historian say, well, there's nothing in those sources that says what Francis thought about it, but everything else we see shows him as such a pacifist that it just doesn't make any sense for him to be in favor of the Crusades. Francis was involved in a battle between city-states as a young man before his religious conversion, and that seems to have left a very strong mark on him. So it could be that he was a general pacifist.
Yeah.
But it could also be that he was only concerned with peace among Christians, and that when it came to to unbelievers, the same rules did not apply. So we just don't know, but there's certainly no certain reason to think, no certain evidence that he was against the Crusades.
Okay. Well, there must be a lot of other ways in which we use Francis, or we in the 20th century misunderstand him, misappropriate him. If some of the famous stories about him are ones that that either never happened, like the First Order mm-hmm. Miss, or we're drawing the wrong conclusions, like the Second Order Miss and the Third Order Miss, what does that say about, if you will, our overall pictures of Francis?
So the Class 3 myth.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, the image that a lot of people have of Francis is that he was somehow a modern liberal born 800 years too soon.
Liberal and pacifist and environmentalist yeah. and all that kind of stuff. Okay.
Yeah, so again, he may or may not have been a complete pacifist.
Right, that's up in the air.
Right. He was not an ecologist Sierra Club style, or right. I should say Greenpeace style.
Okay, yeah. Yeah.
He was
Greenpeace
not.
Greenpeace are more activists, more yes, willing exactly. to throw themselves.
Exactly. Yeah, maybe right. he would have been happy with the Sierra Club. I don't know. But,
well, there's a lot of hiking and birds involved in the Sierra
exactly,
Club.
Exactly. So. Exactly. So maybe that's not too bad too far a stretch. But he was not a vegetarian.
Right.
And while he honored creation, it was specifically because it was God's creation. So okay. When we think of today, people talking about all life as being related and therefore having a reverence for all life, we're usually
as life, as natural life, as almost exactly. its own God in itself.
Yeah, often yeah. so. Yeah,
yeah, that's what people.
And it's often because of evolution and the idea that, you know, we all come from the same primordial soup, mm-hmm. And therefore, you know, the rabbit hopping around and eating my carrots in the garden is a distant cousin and should be treated as such. But for Francis, there was a family relationship, but it wasn't the same. It wasn't a sense. I mean, there was no sense of evolution in that sense.
Right.
The idea was that because God was Father, all mm-hmm. created things under God were family, including even inanimate things. Hence, you know, brother, sun, and sister, okay. moon.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. Right.
So it was specifically as God's creation. Rather than just as a generically love of nature kind of thing. Okay. And also that his love for animals should also probably be seen as being very close to his love for the poor and for lepers and other human outcasts.
So there is a sort of paternalistic, we need to take care of people and creatures who are less
yeah.
well off than we are.
Yeah, okay. absolutely. Okay. He was not with a lowercase d, I should stress. He was not with a lowercase d a Democrat.
Oh, okay. Politically speaking, yeah.
Yeah,
sure.
He did not. He was not in favor of democracy, or at least, well, it was something that didn't exist very much in his day.
Oh, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
And
yeah.
when it did, it tended to be oligarchy, really, mm-hmm. In certain Italian city-states. But there's no reason to think, even though he emphasized humility for himself and his own friars, there's no reason to think that he was against hierarchy in general.
Okay.
And certainly he was not against the hierarchy of the Catholic Church.
Right. So he believes definitely in the God at the very top, and then there's a hierarchy down through the Pope. Yeah. Through the various cardinals and bishops. Okay.
The classical yeah. and medieval idea of the great chain of being, this sort right. of pyramid of all things.
Yeah, so he's not rebelling against that in any way by being right. fond of animals and other things.
Right, so by being humble, it was a matter of choosing the lowest place in the hierarchy, not saying hierarchy itself is bad.
Oh, okay, that's interesting. That doesn't get onto yoga posters.
Right. And you know, he certainly was not a secular humanist or a Protestant, even though people in those groups find him very easy to identify with mm-hmm. and very easy to admire. I mean, it's kind of hard to hate Francis,
sure,
really, no matter sure. what your political or religious views are.
You may disagree with the hierarchy part, but everything else seems pretty good.
Yeah. But there's often been a tendency to downplay those, you know, when somebody is admiring Francis, for them to downplay those elements of Francis that are unlike them, unlike the viewer.
Oh, okay.
So in the late 19th century, a lot of what made Francis very popular was a biography by a French Protestant named Paul Sabatier in the late 19th century. Mm-hmm. And one of the faults of that particular biography, which was quickly translated into all the European languages, was that it made Francis look suspiciously Protestant. There, and people realized this at the time. They pointed it out that it was a fault of the book, that why is it that Francis, in this biography, does not show the devotion to the Pope and the Mass and the saints that were clearly part of his spirituality?
Right, because you just said that the hierarchy was important.
Yeah, yeah, and he ordered his friars in the rule, the kind of capital R rule, the rule of the order, to show great reverence to priests and bishops, even simple and humble priests who might not have been very well educated. They might not have been really great guys, you know, but he nonetheless said, because they are priests, you must show reverence and honor to them.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, we have these essentially three orders of myths, and this happens so much with prominent people and prominent figures in the past that there are things that literally aren't true, things that are misunderstood, and then the sort of broader picture. What are some of the ways in which these myths have been given to us or sent or brought down to us through popular culture? Because an awful lot of people now get their, even their basic education from movies and books and things like that.
Yeah, in scare quotes, based on a true story.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, so Francis has really, I said that people see in him what they're already thinking about, you know, and Francis has turned into something of a Rorschach blot, that somebody looks at him and what they say they see really tells you more about who they are than who Francis was.
Okay. The creator of the yoga poster rather than the exactly. Francis behind the quote. Okay.
Yeah. So,
yoga people are going to hate me, but we're not anti-yoga on the show by any means.
So we see it, especially in movies. In 1950, there was a movie called The Flowers of St. Francis, which is based on a medieval biography of Francis called the Fioretti, which means the little flowers. And the director and co-writer, Rossellini, explained quite clearly what he was doing. So this is 1950. It's Italy.
Right. In disrepair after the war.
Yes.
In shambles after the war.
In a shambles. And also, you know, feeling really beaten down, disillusioned. Italy's experience of both world wars.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. It's not too likely that you see the light at the end of the tunnel in 1945, 46, 47, right. 50. Yeah.
So he made it quite clear that he was setting up Francis as this character of sweetness and light and optimism and joy and carefree innocence, deliberately as kind of a foil or a counter to post-World War II cynicism and despair that he saw in Italy.
Yeah, and we see this so often in so many things we talk about. That, you know, the 1950 movie about a 12th century saint actually says more about 1950 than it does about the 12th century.
Absolutely. And the same thing happened again in a different way in 1972. There was perhaps a more well-known movie called Brother, Son, Sister, Moon. Mm-hmm. So that's taking its title from quotes from Francis's Canticle of the Creatures.
Right.
Roger Ebert, writing his review at the time.
Good old Roger Ebert.
Said this.
Sadly gone. A fantastic buzz killer in his time.
Yes. case in point, in fact, right here. He said, Franco Zeffirelli's Brother, Son, Sister, Moon is a big, limp Valentine of a movie filled with an excess of sweetness and light. What a shame. His subject is Francis of Assisi, one of the most interesting of saints, but Zeffirelli has portrayed him as sort of the first flower child.
And by that, Ebert's meaning, flower child meaning weak and ineffective and just simply interested in sort of floating around and being and loving nature and not actually doing anything.
Yeah. And this is 1972, right. So it's, you know, he's seeing flower children.
Yeah, I'd like to teach the world to sing. Yeah,
exactly. Right. But it doesn't stop there. In 2003, the Hallmark Channel.
Speaking of Valentines.
Yes. The Hallmark Channel, purveyor of all that is a great historical drama, produced a movie they called Reluctant Saint, Francis of Assisi. And it showed Francis as having very little connection to the hierarchy of the Catholic Church.
Okay, so that's completely wrong.
Absolutely. That's just, absolutely. But also through this story of his audience with the Sultan in the Crusades, the movie showed him as gaining a new respect for Islam and possibly even taking some of his ideas from it.
Okay. And there's no evidence for this in the
no.
real evidence, right?
No, none whatsoever. Well, this is 2003. So this is a year, this comes out 1 year after the Boston Globe has uncovered the abuse scandal in the Catholic Church.
Right. That eventually, eventually shows up in the movie Spotlight.
Exactly. Right. It's less than 2 years after 9/11. Mm-hmm. And it's just weeks. It comes out just weeks after the Iraq invasion. So it's a period when the Catholic hierarchy isn't looking so good.
Right.
And at the same time, when people are trying to tone down the Islamophobia that was reaching a fever pitch around that time. You know, you remember people were being randomly shot and beat up and things.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Not just in America, but abroad. So it was an attempt to use Francis to pour oil on the troubled waters, but at the same time, there's a need to disconnect him from the Catholic Church hierarchy that wasn't looking so good in order for him to be the vehicle for that kind of modern message of peace.
Okay, well, let's take up that issue of pouring oil on troubled waters, because if people are inspired by religious authorities to become better people, and certainly to treat other people better, stop mm-hmm. hating Muslims, start taking care of the environment, mm-hmm. then are there really a problem with historical myths about religious people? Or is it just something that's, a myth, but it turns out to be extremely useful?
Right. Well, this is something, I talked about medieval preaching a few minutes ago.
Yeah.
This is something that if you read medieval preaching manuals, they talk about this because medieval preachers used a lot of stories in their sermons. Mm-hmm. And the authors of preaching manuals say it's okay to use, on the one hand, true historical stories, and on the other hand, to use made-up stories. So, animal fables, for example.
Right.
Or, Jesus himself, of course, told parables, and those are – nobody expected them to be historically true.
No.
But what the authors of these preaching manuals say is you have to be clear about which is which. You have to separate the fact from the fiction.
Oh, okay.
So I think it's both for
– that part gets lost often.
Exactly. So both for the modern day and also as people in Francis's day, churchmen in his day were saying, it's important to sort the fact from fiction. They can both be useful. Mm-hmm. But if you can't tell the difference between them, then that doesn't actually help.
Yeah.
So you can enjoy the myths about Francis, the untrue stories, as it were, or the not historically true stories.
Yeah.
As being just fine, as long as we understand what they are, that these are stories.
And can we get at those myths and take out those myths, or at least show that they're stories by privileging or going back to those early biographers you talked about, the people who wrote very close to the time of his death and who sort of may have talked to people who knew him, may in fact mm-hmm. have known him. Is that a way to get, if we go back to the source, if you will, is that a way to get rid of some of the myths, or at least clarify which ones are myth and which ones are fable?
It helps part way. It helps us get rid of other later stories by saying, well, look, if the early biographers didn't say it, if it doesn't crop up for 100 or 200 or 800 years.
Yeah, 800 years especially.
if somebody made it up last week, then it's probably not true. Just like the prayer of St. Francis, it doesn't appear until 700 years, almost exactly after his death. I think we can put that one to rest.
Right.
But on the other hand, earlier biographers had their own agendas too, because Francis was made a saint very quickly after his death. He dies in 1226. He is officially canonized, I believe, in 1228. That's very, very fast. Thomas of Celano is commissioned to write the first biography in 1228, and he finishes it early the next year.
Right.
So we're very close to Francis's time. But at the same time, just as modern people use history,
right,
people were using history back then.
Mm-hmm.
So when we look at the biographies of Francis that were written in the Middle Ages, a lot of what we're actually looking at is not people who are just trying to describe Francis. What they were trying to do was have a conversation about the nature and direction of the Franciscan order itself.
Oh, okay.
And
so there's a contemporary purpose, a purpose about something to do in the immediate decades after Francis's death.
Yes.
With these biographies. Okay.
And in fact, about a century, give or take, after Francis's time, the cracks begin to appear in the order, and it will eventually split into two different orders. The spirituals, who are the group who are the more idealistic and hard line, and they don't want to compromise, and the conventuals, who are willing to make certain compromises that they think are necessary for running a major ecclesiastical franchise.
Sure.
So part of what's happening in these medieval biographies is people arguing this out. Will the real Francis please stand up?
Okay.
What are the stories about Francis that it is safe to tell?
Right.
That are not going to inspire people to some kind of extremism or something like that.
So in one way, the biographies are like the movies of 1950. They're about mm-hmm. that movies of 1950 are almost as much about 1950 as they are about St. Francis. Mm-hmm. Are the biographies of St. Francis post 1226, 1228 mm-hmm. really about the years post 1226, 28? Or at least there's a strong element of that.
In part, yeah,
yeah.
Definitely. And so, and even if they are telling stories that are historically true, mm-hmm. there's also the question of selection.
Right.
Because the image that they create will depend on not just on what stories they put in, but on what stories they leave out.
All right. Which we find later, of course.
Okay. Right.
Well, speaking of selection, we'd love to select a few biographies, a few good biographies to put on the Buzzkill bookshelf on our website. Can you recommend some?
Sure. Augustine Thompson in 2012 published a book called Francis of Assisi, A New Biography. Mm-hmm. Which has two parts that, well, there's kind of a long and a short version of the book. The short version of the book is just the first part.
Right.
And that is the new biography. But if you get the longer version, the second half of the book is a careful but, and very, on the one hand, very scholarly, but on the other hand, very accessible for the lay reader. Walk through the various myths and arguments and questions and debates about Francis.
Oh, okay.
So that's
In a way, it's one-stop shopping both for the man and the myth.
Okay. Exactly. And then John Tolan, I mentioned earlier, his book St. Francis and the Sultan from 2009 traces the origins of the story about Francis's encounter with the Sultan, but then also looks at the later development of that story over the centuries.
Right. Okay. Can you... We want the buzzkillers to leave a popular story about Francis that's actually true or that's not a myth. Can you leave us with one?
Sure. This is one that actually I think a lot of people don't know, but they see the results of it all the time. Mm-hmm. Every year at Christmas, you go past a church or into a church or past somebody's house, you might see a creche, a manger scene, statues of the birth of the scene of the birth of Jesus. Mm-hmm. The very earliest biography of Francis, Thomas of Celano, indicates that Francis himself came up with this idea and that he was the first one to put one of these things together. Not a painting, mm-hmm. but actually to, kind of put statues together. Exactly. Doing this as a way to help himself imagine what it would have been like to be there. At that point, 1,200 years ago.
I see.
1,200 years before.
What it would have been like to be there is an interesting concept. Okay, so sort of put himself in the scene.
Exactly. And that's entirely in line with 13th century spirituality and imagining what it would be like to be with Jesus in the original day, to be with Mary, to meet these people.
Okay.
So whenever you see a manger scene, Francis invented that.
Well, he certainly invented that, and we've shown how complicated and interesting the rest of his life is as well, not just the yoga poster quotes, but the manger creche scenes everywhere that you see outside Christian churches. So thank you very much, Professor.
My pleasure.
And we'll talk to you next week, Buzzkillers. Over and out.